And support for KMUD comes from Chautauqua Natural Foods in Garberville, just off the town square. Locally owned for 37 years, they specialize in local and organic produce, natural groceries, nutritional supplements, and body care products. The Suji House, their globally inspired restaurant, is now open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturdays, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And as far as having opinions, it's much better for you to call up and speak, and please don't call up and argue with me about what someone else said. You just need to get your voice across, and I'll say five non-controversial words for you, but don't give me a novel and speak for yourself. It's much, much better. 923-39911 is the number, and we've got the herb doctor coming right up. Whoops. Try this.
Welcome to this month's Ask Your Herb Doctor, and my name's Andrew Murray. For those of you who perhaps have never listened to the show, they run every third Friday of the month from 7 till 8 p.m., and we talk about a wide range of topics related to health, alternative health, and uncovering some of the lies, and that's part of this evening's program. I can be reached business hours, Monday through Friday, 1-888-WBM-HERB, and if people have any questions that we don't get around to having live on the air, which we do from 7:30 until the end of the show, the questions can either be posted to me at andrew@westernbotanicalmedicine.com, or you can go ahead and call up and leave a voicemail if you don't find a person answering. So like I said, it's a live show, and from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, we have questions either related to this month's subject of more misconceptions, lies, education, and re-education. And if people have other questions for Dr. Pete about health topics or about substances or protocols, etc., the number here, if you're outside the area code is 707-923-2513. So 707-923-2513. There is an 800 number. It's 800-568-3723. 800-568-3723. And we'll be taking calls from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. So this month I wanted to go over subjects, some of which we have covered for sure, but I can't emphasize enough the indoctrination that definitely myself has been through in medical education, and which is very difficult. I think very difficult to unlearn. It's not saying that I haven't unlearned it, but it's. I think it's far better if you're going to get educated in real medicine and science, that you get your facts right the first time round. I know Dr. Pete, when he was studying, had to overcome quite a lot of that bias while he was doing his PhD, and I think he would speak to the fact that he just had to keep quiet half the time because it would not have boded well had he have spoken up, perhaps. But anyway, so I wanted to start off the show with a paragraph that I've kind of written to just introduce the subject, and then to introduce Dr. Pete, and then to basically get into the substance of tonight's show. I wanted to say from the very beginning here that there's such a complex web of both ignorance, bias, and deceit woven into medicine and its practice and evaluation, from peer-pressured competitive education through to the brutal and exhausting residencies that are the perfect breeding ground for the lack of a questioning scientific inquiry and acceptance of the status quo. In terms of medical practice, that it's no wonder progress has been slow and that the previously rational objective principles which it once stood on has now given way to marketing and designer drugs for ever-increasing diagnoses. Couple this with a biological understanding that's no longer holistic, and it's a perfect storm. Advertising and marketing have probably been the most invasive elements of medicine, and monopoly profits foster this arrangement superbly. Over the last 10 years of doing these interviews with Dr. Pete time and time again, what I thought was grounded in science has been far from it, and it's the reality of buyer beware. Do your own research, question and search, and don't just take your doctor's word for it. They're under pressure to perform and within the standard medical protocols, not thinking outside the box, as this is a surefire way to lose your license to practice as malpractice. So how do we get to this point, where it was initially first do no harm, and now iatrogenic death or disease is commonplace to the point research is biased, it's funded by powerful interests, it's doing more harm than good, and it's supported by government. So before we take a look at some examples in which stunning misconceptions are rapidly repeated as truth amongst the population, let me introduce Dr. Raymond Pete. Dr. Pete, you there?
Yep.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us again, as you have been doing for a long time now. For those people who perhaps have not heard the shows before or even heard you, would you give an outline of your academic and professional background?
I was a school teacher in several different subjects first. I've taught college, happened to be introductory physics for biology majors was my first college course that I taught, but along with several other courses, including art, theory and appreciation, and introduction to computers and different things. But then I mostly was teaching English and humanities related subjects before I went back to get a degree in biology at the University of Oregon in 1968. I had already been teaching and studying in different subjects for several years. So I did my dissertation on I was intending to do it on the brain nervous system to understand how that forms a basis for consciousness. But when I saw the world of the neurology people, the brain researchers, I looked for the other end of the animal and found an actually scientific sort of lab over at the other end of the department doing reproductive physiology, and so I did my dissertation on that, age-related processes in the uterus, how aging changes the respiratory mechanism and process of the reproductive system. And since then, I've just been continuing to work on everything between the brain and the reproductive system related to biology.
Yeah. Okay. I spoke a little bit at the very beginning here to the, whilst you were going through your education, probably on numerous occasions, you've come across research papers suggesting something quite the opposite of what was being pushed and or what your dissertation would have or should have contained, perhaps. That's an interesting another point there.
For example, my thesis professor, Soderwall, asked me how my work was going, and I said it was looking like the older animals had more intense respiration in their uterus, which would be the same as increased estrogen. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Carry on. And other professors would have said, wait, that's contrary to the textbook. Stop and do something else. In fact, I had watched professors in other departments say, oh, you have to find something that is going to be consistent with our project here.
Right. How often was that the case, perhaps, where you'd come up with some information or some evidence of counter?
In this department, Sodervall in reproductive physiology, he was on the female reproductive physiology side. He accepted anything we came up with. But hey. Even the male reproductive side, they were old fogey professors that insisted on not departing from the textbook.
Right, there reality. You go. I think that's probably what I was expecting to hear, but in terms of maintaining their egos and all the quote-unquote hard work they did to get where they were.
I think the reason for that was that female reproductive physiology was the low rank on the totem pole of the sciences.
Interesting. Well, it's probably a very pivotal point at this point in time. Okay, I wanted to say to you also that, you've repeated this quote quite a few times, that a lie spreads around the world faster than truth can get its shoelaces, or tie its shoelaces. And when this lie is promulgated by big pharma and big advertising, the FDA, as well as the government, there's little opposition. And it seems so often that the lie is so massive and the deception is so apparently clear when you look in the right direction that until it's challenged, people accept it as fact. And I know we've gone through this again, and I hope it doesn't bore you. And the reason I want to ask about some of these questions as related to your newsletter is that I think I'd be the first to raise my hand and say that I think the initial education does such a good job at brainwashing you in a certain direction, and everything you read, everything you see, everything you hear by most people recapitulating these lies that they don't know any better about, it makes a very kind of very strong fortress that you have to break through. In terms of, I know that you've practiced this a lot, and since I've been working with you and Sarah's been working with you, I've seen definite positive changes in the way that you apply the science of what you've been talking about on the radio shows here with progesterone and pregnenolone, using thyroid aspirin, and the other compounds that you're talking about as being energy saving, not energy wasting, and anti-estrogenic, and all of these things have just flown in the face of everything that I would have been taught, which was current medical model, and which has still to this day been taught, and which big pharma and advertising continue to push. And so the question of the serotonins and the reuptake inhibitors was something I wanted to visit again. And obviously, if people are listening, great, because you're hearing it right now, but obviously the radio shows are archived. People have put them up on YouTube. They're on our website, although I've got a backlog, the best part of a year and a half that I need to put up. But that people need to hear it time and time again, because otherwise it's just swept under the carpet, and tomorrow you'll hear how good SSRIs are, or you'll look at the TV. Well, not that we have a TV, but people that are watching TV are seeing these adverts for these drugs, and, oh, it's just normal. Oh, you take an SSRI if you're depressed. And so I wanted to basically get you to go through serotonin and the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors to get an idea of this kind of ideology that they're pushing, because the fact is it's not the way it is. And so I think people really need to hear this, and this, as well as a few other substances that we'll cover in the show. Just want to make it very clear for people what these things are, and so they get prescribed them. They need to know ahead of time what they're dealing with. The archives are there, and I've often said these shows will stand as a kind of testimony over time to your work and understanding. So would you please explain what we're told about serotonin first? I mean, how they say, oh, it's the happy hormone, and how they get away with that, and how we're told it's useful, and then go through the misconceptions of it being a happy drug, and then explain what you know and understand about its activity to make it very clear for people to know what it is they're dealing with.
I have looked at that recently on some of the best-known medical websites on the Internet, and they're still basically saying the same thing.
Yeah.
No one has looked at the critical information in the least in a very public spot on the internet. And when serotonin was identified chemically as something in the body, it was seen to constrict smooth muscles, in first the intestine, then blood vessels, the uterus, and then it was discovered to exist in the brain. And in the first several years, up into the mid and late 60s, people were still looking at the actual research, and they would look for things that worked with it or antagonized it. Yeah. And they saw that things like the ergot family, LSD, uh-huh. and related things, were able to block it, prevent the actions of constricting muscles in all of the known tissues.
But by blocking serotonin, you're saying?
Blocking the nerves, the main nerves that produce serotonin,
okay.
are just turned off by LSD and psilocybin and the best known psychedelics. As that was being known in the 1960s, the government was also coming out and starting to criminalize the psychedelic chemicals, which were in the news repeatedly as anti-serotonin agents. And when the government criminalized these, the drug companies were starting to see that they could form the basis of drug products, and it was in their interest to say that those evil, illegal drugs are anti-serotonin, and naturally they make you insane and kill you and so on, because the good stuff which makes you sane is serotonin.
Wow.
And that created a foundation of public opinion to build the whole
narrative,
whole myth,
huh?
On the same way the government puts out stories politically and economically and such to create a background of belief,
mm-hmm.
In which future events can be backed up. So the government has been creating political myths. The chemical companies use the government to support their economic sales myths.
Right. And protect the companies, no doubt. To some degree, sure.
The companies are supposedly defending the healthy, sane parts of the organism, and the psychedelic people are threatening the sanity of the population. And so that implies if you go crazy when you take an anti-serotonin agent, then what you need is some products to increase your serotonin.
So tell me what you know about the harmful effects of serotonin, because obviously these things, we'll talk about the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, just after. But what do you know about serotonin and why you don't want to be exposed to it and why you don't want it lingering longer?
Yeah, the animal research has the advantage that they can take fluids from anywhere in the animal or grind up its brain and extract, see what's actually in there where you can't grind up a person's tissues. And if you stress an animal, injure it in horrible ways, suffocate it, for example, you will increase some of the stress hormones, cortisol, estrogen, and serotonin. Our chronic stress increases serotonin in the brain as well as several other tissues. If you make an animal unusually happy, comparing an average lab animal or one which has been tortured deliberately, right, or one which has been put in a big vacation space with entertaining yep. things to do. The one that is suffering from all kinds of mistreatment will have high cortisol and lower adrenaline, usually. The cortisol is driven up by the corticotropic release hormone, which is activated primarily by serotonin. So serotonin, in triggering the stress hormones, rises itself. And so yeah. in these miserable animals, their serotonin is higher. The happiest animals have the lowest serotonin, as well as lower acetylcholine, and generally a little higher adrenaline. They're very alert, learn very well, and have a very low serotonin. If you give these exactly the same chemicals that you are giving, starting to increasingly young kids, if you give SSRIs to adolescent hamsters, for example, they become vicious and aggressive.
Do you understand the mechanism by which this the increased serotonin would cause the aggression? What system that would be supporting?
I don't think anyone does. Right. There are lots right. of.
All right, but aggression is definitely associated with increased serotonin.
There are lots of situations. different parts of the brain will show up different amounts, but this in general, you can suppress the aggression by giving them a hopeless kind of stress.
Okay, well, like the inescapable stress that you've mentioned in the past?
Yeah, the hopeless, helpless stress.
Right.
Serotonin seems to be the crucial thing for putting that into effect. And anti-serotonin drugs they're starting to be used as antidepressants, but they have been used to cure learned helplessness and so on.
Well, there you go. And that's in a nutshell what we've just said just in that last sentence, that the anti-serotonin drugs are being used.
Yeah, about 35 or 40 years ago, a psychiatrist-psychologist, C.R. Cloninger, was defining personality types and relating people to animal studies. He was proposing that higher serotonin in the process of making people more depressed or anxious or aggressive, the type of personality promoted by that was harm avoidance, rather than creative activity. The animals
was withdrawn?
Figured out different ways to avoid being hurt,
right,
fearful, anxious, and so on.
Now, isn't suicide increased as part of the kind of disclaimer literature in SSRI?
Looking at the brains of people who commit suicide, they have found several different kinds of support for the idea that they were suffering from excess serotonin production.
Yeah. Okay. All right, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. From 7:30 to the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions. The local number here, 923-3911. The area code is 707, so that's 707-923-3911. Or you can use an 800 number. That's still in effect, is it, the 800 number?
I'm not sure.
Okay, all right. Well, the 800 number is 800-KMUD-RAD, which is 1-800-568-3723. But if you just dial 707, you'll get here from anywhere.
Yeah, and that way you pay the bill instead of us, because okay, well, we didn't quite make our pledge.
All right, there you go. Oh, look out. Okay.
And I wanted to remind our international listeners, please do hit the Donate Now button, because I know a bunch of you just tune in and you missed our pledge drive because it was at the wrong spot, and I know we have a bunch of regulars. So,
all right.
Thank you for listening.
Good, good. Okay. So, Dr. Pete.
I wanted to mention that 50 years after he and his partner defined the famous experiments for learned helplessness, he and his partner revised their theory and decided that it was in humans too, caused by increased serotonin. Originally, they had suggested it might be the loss of serotonin, but that they have changed their minds now.
And then again, the kind of other misconception that people have, that serotonin and melatonin are just happy chemicals and that we need more of it. And so why is it we're just so brainwashed into
yeah, especially when the people who really have defined the context for current discussion have changed their mind.
Okay. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit now about monoamine oxidase. And again, this in conjunction with serotonin. So most people have heard of MAOs and MAOIs, the monoamine oxidase and the monoamine oxidase inhibitors. Again, this has been completely deranged in terms of what's actually happening with it. But monoamine oxidase, and it does actually break down serotonin. That is truthful enough. They haven't, that's not been altered. And we have these medications, MAOIs, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, to prevent the breakdown and increase the levels of serotonin available. They're also marketed for improving other monoamines like dopamine and norepinephrine, saying that these can increase as low levels are implicated in depression. What do you think about low levels of these monoamines, other monoamines like dopamine and norepinephrine in depression? I mean, you've already mentioned the animal experiments with the more attentive hamsters or whatever rodent that was used.
When they all come up together, things tend to stay more in balance when you have adrenaline, norepinephrine, dopamine, acetylcholine, all coming up at the same time.
Okay. Now wouldn't you suggest that anti-serotonin drugs would be useful
for Parkinson's? They are being used for all of the things now known to be promoted by serotonin. There are anti-serotonin products starting to be studied and recommended against cancer, arthritis, autoimmune diseases, depression, psychosis.
I wonder how is it that we go...
Lung disease, especially.
Go on. Yeah. So I wonder how it is we go three or four decades under this complete farce and people suffer and or die, and then 4 decades later, it's just what you've mentioned about a lie getting around the world faster than truth can tie their shoelaces. Because it's only really been in the last couple of years that there's been a pushback against polyunsaturates and actually some studies showing how beneficial saturated fats are.
I think there's a historical rule that every stupid medical idea lasts about 50 years.
And again, I can't help but thinking it's just the brutal, egotistical education that doctors go through, and that they come out the other side of it thinking that they've got a handle on it and they're not going to listen or read anything else, and this is what they're going to prescribe because science has got it right and the drugs that they've got in their hands are indicated for the disease and it's standard medical practice and next. Okay.
A local caller got it in 5 words. How does psilocybin fit in?
Okay. So, Dr. Pete, you mentioned first off the ergotamines or the LSD, psilocybin, being used as anti-serotonins. So I think...
Psilocybin, I think, works very similarly to LSD on suppressing the serotonin nerves. Some of the others, there is a little overlap with the amphetamine derivatives, and mescaline I don't know that much about, but it doesn't work exactly on those same nerves.
I'm pretty sure I read that Colorado or one of those states there had legalized psilocybin and other hallucinogens as part of parcel, a bit like the 215 was here 15, 20 years ago, started as a kind of treatment for various different medical problems that people could get a certificate for. So that's interesting if that's if that comes around, because like you said, all the initial research into LSD and psilocybin was probably going in a pretty good direction until it was scuppered by the serotonin industry.
Yeah, they were seeing good results in treating alcoholism and depression and a lot of psychiatric things.
Yeah. When do you think serotonin would be useful? I mean, because I know we produce it ourselves, so it's got to have some activity that you could quote-unquote call useful, but is there any instances where you think serotonin is useful?
I think the place that it operates is so at the heart of things that it's best to let it develop under its own rules. Mm. For example, the tryptophan, which is turned into serotonin, it has a resonant aromatic electron system, which is very responsive to light, electromagnetic energy, and oxidation reduction. And this is in practically all proteins, this amino acid. And so those proteins intrinsically have their electronic uniqueness, which makes them responsive to the interaction with other molecules. It lets the whole molecule have the possibility of resonantly interacting with its environment. So it's sort of like the nerve center of each protein molecule. And the structure of most cells, every cell in some condition, is built on and uses to move the microtrabecular, microarchitecture of the cell, a framework of filaments and tubes that give the cell stiffness and movement. And these are increasingly being thought to be electronically or oxidoreductively interactive with mobile electrons, giving the tube a special function in the structure, not just stiffness, but also electronic interactions across the whole cell simultaneously. So again, it's like the nerve system in a protein is tryptophan, nerve system in the cell is the microtubules containing these proteins. Okay. And serotonin acts on these responsive proteins and microtubules and other systems in the cell with a special interaction. So serotonin can stop the polymerization of the microstructure of a cell, can interrupt it so that it can start de-differentiating and getting ready to divide. And when something is so basic to the existence of a cell, I think it's the worst thing you can do to try to intervene by giving a pill
right.
to someone.
Yeah,
it's like trying, if you have an electric motor, trying to pour tar into it for fuel or gasoline.
Yeah, or giving it lightning to try and make it work when all it needs is a a 120 volt system.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, we do actually have a bunch of callers lined up, so let's start taking these callers and see where they go. So, caller, you're on the air. What's your question and where are you from?
I'm from New York. Can you hear me?
Say that again? Yeah, I lost the first part of that.
I'm from New York.
New York. Okay. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
So this is for Pete. Basically, you know, I was physically active until 50. When at that point, I got a swelling on my ankle, and the doctor diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
Then when I read more about that in the internet, you know, it looks like hundreds of conditions have this, you know, the called RA, and then they seem to treat everybody pretty much with the steroids. So, whether it's a severe case or a simple case, it looks like they have the same kind of treatment. Although mine, you know, I don't feel that crazy, but the doctor that was diagnosed RA. Does Dr. Pete have any idea on this, suggestion?
Dr. Pete, I've got a lot of feedback on my end here, and I couldn't really make out a lot of what he was saying. Did you catch that?
I couldn't either.
No. Rheumatoid arthritis is what I had heard.
Yeah, I heard that, but what was... was he looking for your approach to rheumatoid arthritis? Caller, was that what you wanted?
No. So I'm just saying, mine seems to me, based on the pain and things like that, is so less severe compared to some other real... RA symptoms, but still the doctors say that, you know, the treatment is pretty much same with the steroids and things like that.
Okay.
So it's like hundreds of conditions of RA, they say, you know, it's just, so how are they able to, first of all, you know, diagnose anything as an RA and then, you know, give the same kind of medications, whether it's severe, less severe, or simple cases.
So this is about the differential diagnosis for rheumatoid?
Or I think that he thinks he has a very mild case of the rheumatoid and doesn't want to do the really intense intervention.
So, Dr. Pete, I know you've got a different idea and intuition about rheumatoid. Not intuition, it's based in science, but it's how would you approach rheumatoid arthritis?
I've seen several people. Seems like every couple of years I run across one. Their doctors have all told them that they're incurable and just stop thinking about it, apparently. They don't want to, at first, they don't want to hear criticism. Doctors sometimes are telling them to take estrogen, even. But always glucocorticoid is part of the treatment. Mm-hmm. But... I think if you find out what's causing it, sometimes you just discover that the easiest thing is to realize that maybe you didn't have that diagnosis in the first place. The foods that you're eating or supplements you're taking, or especially if you're taking a serotonin or an estrogen drug, those are enough to bring it on.
So we still believe in the inflammatory process mediating swollen joints and the presence of rheumatoid factor in the blood. You think that's definitely a differential?
No. It will go away if you don't have it anymore. Same with lupus.
Right.
Another person with lupus recently stopped thinking she had lupus and just started correcting her diet and taking vitamin D and thyroid.
If the caller was asking for this, I know that in terms of traditional herbal medicine for the treatment of rheumatoid, excretion is definitely a system to be supported and strengthened, as is things that support the liver because of the excretion. So basic things like celery seed and devil's claw have totally been used as anti-inflammatories, I think, mainly. And then any of the kind of waste-clearing products like burdock or yellow dock to aid in either bile production and metabolism, as well as to improve a laxative effect. I think there's definitely mileage in clearing waste and the anti-inflammatories.
But just avoiding some of the foods that have been causing intestinal inflammation, yeah. I think, is the first thing to look through your diet and see what things might be hard to digest or might be leaving something inflammatory. And using a regular fibrous food in the diet sometimes is enough to tremendously reduce inflammation.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, but because you're a complete proponent of bowels being the seat of your health, and so improving your intestinal health will decrease endotoxin, etc. Okay, so let's take the next call to make sure we get through these two before we carry on with tonight's discussion. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from? Hopefully there's no feedback.
Hi, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, hi. What's your question?
My dad recently had a health scare where he was on vacation at high altitude, and he experienced shortness of breath, excessive coughing, bloodiness, phlegm, and feeling tired. In a hospital, a doctor at the hospital took his blood work and diagnosed him as having a heart attack. And after more blood work, like a day later, a CT scan and further assessment, they said he just had pneumonia, and they said it was not a heart attack. But I wish we could have avoided the harmful effects of the CT scan and just got the diagnosis of pneumonia first. So my question is, how can you diagnose cardiovascular disease in a safe way without resorting to a CT scan or angiogram? Basically, what's the ideal way to diagnose cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, Dr. Pete.
I think the first thing a person notices is that they're having trouble doing their usual energetic activities. There's something going wrong with their circulatory system.
And then would you be thinking along the lines, I mean, the typical model would be stress-induced pain, exercise-induced pain, for angina, for sure, and in terms of functional, stable or unstable angina. I find that kind of strange that they would put down to the event as a heart attack. There are certain enzymes that are leaked by cardiac muscle in response to that ischemia that's the result of heart attack. So how reliable do you think those enzymes are as a marker?
Somewhat, but I wouldn't trust them in myself.
Okay.
There are a couple types of enzyme. One is a particular heart protein.
Right.
You can trust that. But just stress and exertion, the same way that you can damage a muscle by running too far or too fast uphill or such, overexertion. And so if your energy supply is low, if you're hypoglycemic and running on fat, and stored energy, exertion can damage any muscle, including your heart muscle, just by extreme overexertion. So if it's just somewhat borderline evidence of a heart attack, you wouldn't necessarily do anything more than take good care of yourself.
And I know I want to ask you this question for myself. I'm just curious as to your response. But one of the first things that they'll want to do, I imagine, I'm not a medical doctor, but I imagine they'll want to do examination of the vasculature of the heart and inject dyes and give you an angiogram. And what do you think about the components of the dye and or any risk associated with angiograms?
If you're not sure that your heart has been slightly injured just because you have a slightly different feeling, when you get a chemical injected into your heart, and then especially if you exercise with that chemical in your heart, the chemical itself is going to irritate things and cause some damage. So it isn't an entirely free and safe thing to do. You have to really suspect that there's something to look for, and then what are you going to do if you find it?
Right, right. Because I mean, stents or bypass artery grafting is the current.
For about 30 or 40 years now, there has been they call it MAGIC, M-A-G-I-K, standing for magnesium, glucose, insulin, and potassium, which they give to someone, if possible, at the very beginning of a heart attack. But at any point, it accelerates the healing of heart. The glucose lowers, both the glucose and the insulin lower the free fatty acids, which are a major damaging factor in causing a heart attack, and that will actually be made worse by the dye examination. But this treatment they give is a simple injection of magnesium, potassium,
glucose and insulin?
Insulin.
Yeah. Interesting.
The glucose itself helps to reduce the stress. The insulin helps to lower the fatty acids and let the heart use the glucose. Both of those help the cells to take up the potassium and magnesium they need to restore their energy.
Got it.
A small amount of orange juice or sugar with the active T3 hormone has been used the same way. The T3 is anabolic, like insulin, helps the cell to take up both the magnesium and potassium.
I just wanted to also say from an herbal medicine perspective that in Germany they have published quite a few papers supporting hawthorn extract. And they said in their papers that if a patient is administered hawthorn extract within 12 hours of a myocardial infarct, it significantly decreases the ischemic damage. And so I think there's a rational use for antioxidant anthocyanins that are contained in the product for heart attack, but I just want to make sure people are aware of that. That's actual reality. Good research from Germany. Okay, I think we have two more calls on the line. Let's take the next caller. Call away from. What's your question?
Hi there. Have you got me?
Yes.
I'm from the Garberville area. Thank you very much for the show. A while ago, you were speaking about serotonin and anti-serotonin compounds, for the lack of a better word, have been used in a psychiatric sense. And my father battled his entire life, as far as I know, and had multiple diagnoses. And I remember clearly Haldol and Thorazine, and I may be just asking inappropriately, but was the action of those antipsychotics similar to the antidepressant action that you were speaking of? Was there improper use of these compounds 30, 40 years ago? Thank you very much.
Yeah, one second. Yeah. Thorazine and
Haldol. I remember Haldol as being an antipsychotic. I was, a teenager and was helping him, so I may not have remembered the name correctly.
Do you, Dr. Pete, do you have much to say about Thorazine and or Haldol? I've not heard of Haldol, heard of Thorazine, but...
I have the impression that Haldol was a danger to that system, but I'm not sure about Thorazine. I think the main problem with that was that it was given in such large amounts that people lost functioning.
Indeed.
But it was a supposed antidepressant, right?
Or antipsychotic.
Antipsychotic, yeah.
I think mostly it just quieted people down.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, we have another call, so let's get this next caller. Caller, you are on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hi, I'm from Utah.
Utah.
Andrew. Hi, Dr. Pete. Dr. Pete, I was wondering why you choose to live in Oregon as opposed to someplace like New Mexico with a lot of sun, highly elevated, possibly clean air. Thanks.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely not for health, but it was the location of the University of Oregon Library. I lived close enough to it that I could walk to the library regularly. And in Los Angeles, for example, there was no way to get to a big library simply.
There we go. Okay.
Thank you.
Simple answer. I know you've been asked that before, for sure. I've even thought it myself and asked you. Okay. All right. So the number here, if you're in the area or out of the area or anywhere else, 707-923-3911. And then from now until about 5 to the hour here, the next 5 minutes, you're invited to call in with any questions related or unrelated to this week's discussion of what we're told is the truth, but actually what the science shows us. I was going to actually ask you about the next thing that is a mistaken belief. Oh, and there goes the light. So rather than me, let's get the next question in. Caller, you're on the air. There's one more coming in. Okay, caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
My question is, I'm from Arcata.
Okay.
And my question is maybe a little pep talk on skillful eating for diabetics.
All right, you want a pep talk for... okay, well, Dr. P, I know that you're going to have a very different answer to the medical... the medical elective, in terms of a diabetic and their diet, what would you speak to it?
Well, avoiding serotonin-promoting drugs is one thing, because that's a factor in creating diabetes as well as the other things it does. But my experience with diabetes started with my father having a diagnosis of extreme diabetes of the classical kind, in which he had lost about 50 pounds of weight and wasn't very big to start with. By looking at the old literature, medical literature from the beginning of the century, that they found that eating certain foods, in his case it was primarily brewer's yeast, But he totally cured himself, lived about 35 years after that. That got me interested, and I read that in the 19th century, England and France, there were two doctors who absolutely cured the mortally sick very, very profoundly diabetic people by letting them, first they thought they were just going to let them die happy by not starving them for sweets, but they let them eat as much sugar as they wanted, and that happened to be almost a pound of sugar a day, and instead of dying over a period of several days, the conversion of protein to sugar decreased and finally stopped, and they recovered.
And stopped wasting.
What they had done was broken the pattern of stress simply by letting them follow their appetites. That led to investigating what actually is the cause of diabetes, not eating sugar for sure. Sugar, the beta cells that make insulin are always regenerating, and sugar promotes that regeneration and supports it. If you don't have sugar, they can be created as insulin-producing cells, but then die. And it's the free fatty acids,
right,
which are killing the beta cells constantly.
Right, because if you don't have enough sugar, you break your muscle tissue down, you generate free fatty acids in an attempt to raise glucose.
So there is animal research that really pretty well explains it, but doctors don't want to listen to that.
Well, there's the whole medical malpractice thing that they are under because they're not following standard medical procedure, because that's not the way forward for them. Okay, well, let's take this next caller because we do have one more caller on the air. Let's get this question. Where are you from, caller? What's your question?
Hi, I'm from Texas, and my question is, besides altitude, is there any other characteristic that affects thyroid function? So for, I actually heard population density is associated with serotonin levels like that. Is there any other characteristic of a location that affects thyroid?
Dr. Pete, did you get that?
Not all of it, but living situation, how it affects thyroid.
What was the first thing you said, caller?
So I know altitude for a location affects thyroid function.
Right.
Is there anything else, any other characteristics
positively
of locations, like total rainfall or just some other metric is related to thyroid function?
Yeah. Is there anything that you know that positively stimulates thyroid function, that it may be the sunlight or we've mentioned altitude or CO2 in certain geographical locations that would be positively beneficial or improving thyroid function?
Well, avoiding very long winters is important because of the stress of the long nights. But I think altitude is very important because the high oxygen pressure at sea level is constantly creating stress in itself. A random tendency to oxidize fats spontaneously, which disappears at a higher altitude when you find the right altitude for your particular adaptation. Then you're able to retain the right amount of carbon dioxide so that oxidative processes run more smoothly without stress.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you for that, Dr. Pete. We've only got a few minutes here to the top of the hour, and the engineer says that there's an easy question here that was called in, so let's just get this one.
And it's five words. Does acetaminophen impact steroid production?
It definitely impacts the liver, but does acetaminophen impact steroid function?
Nothing that occurs to me right now.
Yeah.
But through damage to your liver, it undoubtedly will.
Undoubtedly, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much again, Dr. Pete, for giving your time. And I'll spend the next couple of minutes letting people know how they can reach you and or read about your work.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so for those people who called in tonight, thank you. For those people that listened and didn't call in, thank you for listening. The shows are archived on KMUD's website. So if you go to the audio archives, you can look at Friday Night Talk. Every third Friday of the month from 7 to 8 p.m. is the show that we're on, although they only keep the archives for 2 months, I think, or 90 days. They used to keep it for a long, long time, but they only keep it for 3 months. Anyway, so a lot of the radio shows that we've done with Dr. Pete over the last 10 years are on our website, which is www.westernbotanicalmedicine.com, on the resources tab in the right top corner. Drop that down. All of the shows that we've done up until 2017, at the end of 2017, are there. I've got 18s and 19s to go up, just haven't done it at this point in time. And there's a lot of the radio shows have been put on YouTube. So there's a resource out there, and Dr. Pete, who's the creator of all of the content, folks, and there's another moot point here in terms of copyright and it being put up on YouTube without our permission. The actual information is Dr. Pete's own original work, so he has copyright on that work. His website is www.raypete.com, and he's got lots of articles that he's written over the years that are fully referenced, extensive scientific articles, and his knowledge and wisdom has been poured into them. Just like these radio shows, they're for the future generations and for the truth to bear out what he's been saying all this time. Until the third Friday of October, happy fall.
And support for KMUD comes from the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, now updating its strategic energy plan for Humboldt County and seeking public input. More information, including how to share your ideas on energy generation, regional planning, low-carbon transportation, and energy efficiency, can be found at redwoodenergy.org or by calling 707-269-1700. It is 8 o'clock, 68 degrees. This is Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville.